Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. With us in the studios of CBS Interactive today, new business director in Ocean Australia, James Welsh.
Hello, Tim.
Mumbrella deputy editor Robin Hicks.
Hi, Tim.
And podcast producer Alice Terlikovsky.
Hi, Tim.
This week...
Oh, well, my little brother thinks he's magic.
I reckon he's magic.
Campaigns galore. A look at this week's new ads, including Vegemite's salute to everyday Aussies.
GPY and Are They In The Wrong?
Facebook number one for social Aussies.
Mornings, talent and amateur cooks. The Week in TV.
To pitch or not to pitch.
And do the public even care about good journalism? So James, welcome back to the podcast. Let's catch up on life at Ocean since you were last in. New hire, I apologise in advance for the pronunciation. Colette Van Ruyen, how did I do?
Royen,
well, that's Van not Ruyen. Bad. From Pacific Magazines. Probably one of your first staffers to come in from a non-agency background, coming into a digital role. What's the thinking on the hire there?
Colette's great. She's a good person to work with because she talks about the consumers, and you know, coming from a publishing background, it's all been about the readers and of the magazines and therefore the online publications.
These people who you ad folk are a little out of touch with.
Well, thanks for that. So it's great to have Colette coming in.
More of a question than a statement.
I thought I'd just move on and ignore that one. So it's good to have Colette part of the team, and it's good to have somebody from a different background rather than just doing the traditional stuff from agency, digital agency land. You can bring a different perspective in.
And any other sort of big staff moves since you came in, which was probably about 2 months ago? I think we were announcing your appointment amongst others last time around.
Well, we've had an influx of women to the team. We've got Colette, we've got Joe Gilbert, who runs the events and sponsorship team. We've got Tania Templeton, who heads up our broadcast team. And then we've also got Amanda, who you met recently.
These are most of them are new arrivals.
And the team has just been growing, and we're still looking for a whole load of people. So if you know any good planners or good creatives...
I was reading, actually, the other day, this is going slightly off topic, but someone, I can't even remember where I was reading, or someone was talking about it, the price of planners is going up at the moment. You know, there seems to be a bit of a sort of... That's one of the kind of sort of shortfall areas in the market. Are you finding that good planners are kind of thin on the ground?
Planners are in hot demand. You know, talking to any of the recruitment guys, there are great planners out there, but they're enjoying being freelance or they're happily hitched up towards the agency they're with. So we're talking to a few people at the moment, just trying to find the right person who'll come on board and help us grow our business.
Well, let's talk about the work. Your foundation clients, Kia and Hyundai.
Hyundai. I had to pick you up on that one, Tim.
Absolutely, because I don't think you did last time. You have your ambitions to be seen as being more than just those sort of in-house brands, so to speak. But your most recent couple of pieces of work have been for them. So let's have a chat about the Makes Perfect Sense Kia ad. Let's just take a listen to a clip there.
In 1998, an American man managed to wear a suit of bees that weighed about 20 kilos. That doesn't make sense. But here's something that makes perfect sense. The 2011 Kia Rio is in run-out, and they're going at $13,490 to make room for the new model. With Bluetooth connectivity and dual front airbags, it's Australia's best value five-door. Now that makes perfect sense.
So that's a piece of work for Kia. Tell us about that one.
Makes Perfect Sense is a campaign that retail campaigns very often feature the dealership, and it's hard to get cut through, especially towards the end of the financial year where everybody's got a sale on. It's a case of standing out, having a story to tell, and Make Perfect Sense as a platform for, you know, the creative direction going forwards is an exciting proposition. And it's one that I think we'll see going forwards for some time for the Kia retail brands.
Now, your creative director, Scott Lambert, I think when we were doing that story, said there's lots more to come with that brand. What is in the pipeline?
There are a couple of things in the pipeline which I look forward to telling you about in the next few weeks. We will see, we're looking at various sort of brand tail piece, but there's also...
So brand tail?
Brand tail. another bit of jargon for you, wonderful.
What is brand tail?
Very briefly, it's a brand piece that also sells. So it's brand plus retail. And throwing in an extra jargon. And what we're looking to do is to have, you know, more work for the Kia brand, but also we've got, over the next 4 months, we've got 7 different campaigns launching, and they're significant campaigns. So 4 for new product launches and 3 for existing products, but just new campaigns. So it's a busy time at the moment. We've got Scott, the creative director, and Kathy, the head of planning, are working flat out on making sure that we have the right work coming through, and then working closely with Colette to make a digital platform for it. Joe on the sponsorship and the events side of things is looking at the launch events, and then working with Tanya, our head of broadcast, and Steve, the head of production, just to make sure these ads get through.
Have you now told us the name of everybody in the agency?
There are 40 of us, so not quite.
So James, can I ask you a question about Colette? She's joined from a non-agency background, which is interesting. So what sort of impact has that had culturally? What she brought to the agency coming from a publishing background? I remember you talking also about, in Ocean, perhaps having a leaning historically towards traditional media, and now you want to up your game in digital. So how's that working?
Colette brings a lot of enthusiasm into the team and a lot of experience from a strategic as well as from a practical and production side of things. So when looking for the head of digital, Amanda and Steve and Scott, we're looking for somebody who would bring both the practical producer side of things, but also really got what's going on within the digital arena. And digital is a little word for a big arena. So everything from social through to creating banner ads, microsites, and websites. And it's really about understanding how it's not just one medium, it's a whole environment upon which you can tell stories in different ways.
And was that appointment driven by the need of the agency to have a stronger digital function and so appeal more to non-Kia and non-Hyundai clients, or is it driven by your clients?
It's driven by the agency growing. It's the need from the current clients, and also from our positioning going forwards for other clients, that prospective clients. Some of the people we're talking to at the moment, digital is a key offering that we've got, a different angle. And in due course, I'd love to show you tangible examples of that. But at the moment, it's all in the pipeline. So Colette's been with us for 3 weeks, so let's give her a chance.
Can I just ask about the InOcean brand? Also, the name is interesting. I remember you saying it's a mixture of innovation and ocean thinking. Is that right?
In 2005, the agency was born in Korea, and at the time, they were looking to find a point of difference, and looking at the two important things are having looking at the big picture or the big ocean, and making sure that you stand for something and standing for innovation, and so hence more jargon.
Do you think that the Korean heritage is a drum worth banging in Australia? I mean, other parts of the world, perhaps in Singapore, where I've just come from, Korean means high tech, high digital penetration, high mobile penetration. Isn't that sort of a strength worth shouting about?
Korea is number 2 in the world for mobile uptake, and Australia is number 3. We can learn a lot from Korea. Cyworld in 1999 was the precursor to Facebook, and so everything, which wasn't until 2006. So there's so much, as you say, happening in the technological landscape of Korea, and it's one of the things that we work closely with our colleagues over there to work out what can we learn from them and what can we have next. And that's something that we're wanting to bring to keynote speeches here in due course, and Colette has embraced that as well. The other side of things, from the Korean sort of philosophy of really looking, and on our business cards, it just has the word beyond on there, and it's a great attitude to just always be going, looking beyond the basic ambition. What else can we do?
Yeah. A quick note on the agency's performance so far this year. I think you gave yourselves a 7 out of 10 for how InOcean's done in the past 12 months. So next year, how are you looking to improve that mark?
We're looking to improve what we're doing for our current clients through having we've now got Joe are running the event side of things and collect the digital side,
yeah.
and really growing those arenas. I mean, the above the line side is we've got a brilliant machine and it's a great agency from that perspective. Joe and Colette are going to be raising the bar from our digital and our in-house events teams to that standard as well. And the other side of things is new business is a key focus for us, and that's why I'm part of the team now, is to work out exactly who is it that we can benefit by working with us, or who would benefit by working
with
us.
And what sort of brands might that be?
We're looking to talk to anybody who you know, high-ticket purchase items, you know, cars don't come cheap, but also...
So that would be your sort of specialty?
There's that, but there's also...
Sort of one-off, irregular purchases.
So, fridges and things like that. You know. But also, from a retail perspective, we really work closely with the dealers as well as working closely with the brand. And a lot of agencies can claim to be great at promotions and in-store and point-of-sale, or great at big brand building. Very few agencies can show how they understand both, and that's something that we're really bringing to life at the moment and talking to people about.
The big problem, though, for an ocean isn't converting pitches, it's getting on pitch lists in the first place. How can you do that? How can you remedy that problem?
Well, it's interesting talking to the pitch consultants that are out and about. They have a preconception about InOcean, and just talking to them one-to-one and hearing what they've said, they're saying great work but don't know the people, and so that's my job, is to get to know the people, because at the end of the day, people buy people. You know, if you've got good work and good people, all you have to do is be out there for in front of the right people at the right time to be able to sell the agency. So I think the reason why I was excited to join the team is I love the work, and having met the people, we've got a great bunch of talented, personable people. So let's get a roadshow together, and let's get out there in front of the prospective clients.
And just before we get into the week's campaigns, again, since you were last in, we saw the launch of the i30 ad, the time-lapse ad, which was shot across four continents. And I must admit, whenever you see a press release about an agency persuading a client that they need to go out and shoot across four continents, my first thought is always, well played.
They had a great trip. It was a good... Actually, the budgets went higher for that predicted production than on any of the other Hyundai productions. It was a very lean team that went to those four continents. For example, our creative director went as far as South Australia. And we did have other people that went out with the teams to the other continents. But it was really the production side of things and the technical side of it. That's where the amazing story comes to life.
It was all shot on Canons, wasn't it? The D5s, D7s,
That's
D1s.
Right.
I can't remember which one it was, but
fives and sevens, D5 and seven, yeah.
Which sort of are the
prosumer?
Yes, the prosumer, and was originally a stills camera, but now makes pretty pictures for video.
The whole campaign was brought together and just to really just look beautiful, and that's where I think the story does work, and why it is a beautiful campaign, and it's just trying to bring. Give a framework for the car in a way that hasn't been done before.
Well, next, campaigns galore, a look at this week's new ads.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace. Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
So it's been a big week for new campaign launches. We've seen a JWT campaign for Vegemite, which centres around a competition to find Aussies who will be toast of a nation. Let's have a listen to one of the TV ads about a real-life flying scientist.
Yeah, apparently he used to be a professor or something.
Yeah, he popped in the other day and he got four lamb's eyes off me. And I said, what do you want that for?
Yeah, he just came in the door here one day and said, I'd like to learn to fly.
Got his pilot's licence, packed up all his gear, and off he went into the outback.
Beagle's a flying scientist, that's what we call him.
He's a flying scientist.
And he flies everywhere.
Teaching science to heaps of kids across Australia.
Yeah, we cut up some eyeballs.
First he cut an eyeball open of a sheep. All the yucky stuff just went splat all out.
Yeah, I wouldn't describe him as a typical scientist, but...
Yeah, just not very tall, little beardy fella.
Kids love him, they just thrive on it, yeah.
Science.
I reckon he's got a massive brain.
Yes, he's very smart.
And he told me to be up, he'd build rockets.
If the aeroplane would go to the moon, I'm quite sure he could get it there.
Oh, well, my little brother thinks he's magic.
I reckon he's magic.
Well, I suppose you could say he's been one of the better scientists out this way.
No, he'd be the only scientist I think that's ever come out this far.
Yeah, Phil, the flying scientist.
Yeah, I don't know what makes him do it.
Yeah, I don't know anyone else that does anything like that for nothing.
I think he's got a bit of Superman in him.
Who's got muscle? Need a strong boy for that one.
Righto. So, yeah, I mean, besides the VW Passat ad, by DDB Sydney, this is probably my favourite ad I've seen since I've been in Australia. I really, really loved it. And besides TV, there was radio, online, social media and on-pat promotion. So, Tim, what did you make of this ad? Do you like it?
Well, I enjoyed it. One of my first cynical thoughts as well is that thing of, well, that was 2 or 3 minutes. What's the 30-second version going to look like? But, yes, the those kids in that ad couldn't sound any more Aussie, could they? I'm not even going to try and do the impression. My first thought actually was he was a fictional character, Figgles. We actually had to check that he was a real character. And similarly with one of the other ones in the series, the Darwin Ice Hockey Club, who I don't think have yet played a game because they're the reigning champions, because no one comes and play them because there is no ice, obviously. It's a nice idea, and I suppose what it does build on is the Australian-ness of Vegemite, you know, so it kind of takes it a new direction. But I really like them.
It did feel to me like a confident brand that knew what it was, knew its heritage. And it did feel like a short film, sort of documentary with a bit of product placement thrown in. I did really, really enjoy it. So, James, what do you think?
I think it's more than just the Australian heritage. I think it's also about the everyday heroes and also just championing the power of imagination. And that's what's exciting about it. More than just being Australiana, it's really telling a story that's engaging and captivating. So I think it's a great piece of work from JWT.
Alice, so what do you think?
I love it. It warms my heart, to say the least. I think, you know, Vegemite is such an iconic Aussie brand, but what I like about it is that they haven't necessarily gone with iconic Australians. They're a bit unique, and I don't know, I really appreciate that they haven't gone for the tackiness appeal of some brands that try to Aussie-fy themselves too much. I think there's a risk with going too far with all the typical Aussie things, and while, as Tim said, that the children were so typically Australian, they couldn't be more Australian. It was done in a tasteful way and they were genuine and sincere. I liked that.
So what do you mean by sort of typically Aussie?
Oh, well, you know, kind of, I guess there's a fine balance between throwing out too many kangaroos and gum trees and hats with corks hanging off it, with going over the top in that sense. We've talked about this with Tourism Australia and kangaroos, you know, Andrew McAvoy defending putting kangaroos in the ad. Yeah. That's one thing, because that's tourism. That's what people want to come here for. But in terms of brands, marketing to Australians in Australia, you've got to strike a fine balance, because Australians are your market.
I'll tell you one question I do ask myself about that campaign is, they found two great, quirky, real stories. And the problem is you get a quirky real story and it very quickly everyone's covering it, you know, it's in the news, everyone knows the story, and half of the power of these ads is, you know, many people won't have come across Figgles before or the Darwin ice hockey team. The question is, how many stories are there out there that are that good that will become an ad that well? In other words, is it going to be hard to keep it going and keep the quality of the campaign up as they carry on?
But didn't it bother you as a cynical journalist that you didn't at first believe that they were true stories?
Well, I think I would have had more of a problem if it turned out they weren't, because they really are presenting it as a true story. And that was almost my question. Now, to me, it's almost the flip side of, I don't know if you remember the McDonald's Playland campaign, where it was shot like it was a documentary, at Circular Quay, where they built this giant playground, and they were catching shots of commuters getting off the train and their faces lighting up in joy and nervously looking around, and then getting like, am I allowed to play on this? And then playing on it, and then it turned out they were all actors, and that was really, really kind of inauthentic. And that was the inauthentic element, because it was presented to viewers as if, hey, you know, we've done this lovely, beautiful thing for, you know, to cheer up commuters' day. Whereas this is the other side of it, you know, the authenticity question is asked, but then it's answered.
I think there are lots of ways to show those type of little stories, and I think every community has a local hero, and it's just a way of finding those stories, and there'll be lots of different ways of interpreting that, and I look forward to seeing how that comes to life across, you know, there's the credit for the social media team and all that, so I look forward to seeing how that really comes to life.
So still on new campaigns, but this time with an emphasis on radio, is Cracker Barrel Vintage Cheddar Cheese, created by BMF Melbourne.
Greetings, I am Baron von Orso. I was born with one taste bud, so sadly I could not taste. But when I discovered the sharp, distinctive taste of Cracker Barrel Vintage Cheddar, my taste bud awoke. It danced like a gypsy, pranced like a stallion. It sang a song to the moon like a werewolf.
Cracker Barrel Vintage Cheddar. Sharp taste for men of distinction.
This too is coupled with other activities. So Tim, sharp cheese, sharp creative?
Do you know what? I really like this. The radio ad you just heard there is good. There are some very good posters as well, you know, very much kind of playing up the kind of almost the kitsch factor. But, you know, very distinctive positioning. I know you can't call too much from just two or three campaigns. The question I was asking myself over the last 3 to 6 months was whether BMF had gone slightly off the boil recently. You know, they weren't putting out any terrible work, but I couldn't remember the last time I saw something that I loved. Recently, I've seen two or three great bits. Again, I get the sense that if they had stuttered slightly, maybe they're back on course.
Yeah, and I saw some what I loved, some great print work for Frouche, featuring Miss J, which took a bit of a ribbing in the comments stream.
Now, Miss J, you have to help me out who Miss J is.
It's a presenter on America. Alice, can you help me here?
Yeah, America's Next Top Model.
Yes,
yeah.
An outrageously camp gentleman who features sort of bounding around in pink.
Gentleman, I like that word.
Yeah. So, you know, I agree. I loved that print camp. It's a great poster, and also loved these posters for Cracker Barrel Vintage Cheddar. But I did think that the radio jarred a little bit with the posters. I mean, the posters were the straight, here's a man of distinction, whereas the radio sort of took away that sort of distinction element.
Yes, this man with one taste bud sort of thing does take it in a slightly different direction.
Perhaps it was right for the medium. I think radio is perhaps a medium that plays to those strengths, but I think the print work, I think they were at odds with each other.
Robin, you've hit the nail on the head. It's not about matching luggage, and that's one thing that I think a lot of agencies do very boringly, is just look at one camp execution and then say, how can we replicate that on a different medium? I like the way it's different on the radio. I think it works beautifully. I like the way they've identified cheese for blokes rather than how do we engage the female grocery buyer for this? It's a different target audience, therefore it's going to stand out as a cheese, and sure enough the female grocery buyer will be buying it.
And I've got to say, I love,
speaking as a female grocery buyer,
I love Cracker Barrel cheese, and I did before I saw this ad anyway, so
Do you feel that ad spoke to you, or was that?
No, not at all. It was almost come across as a refined man's cheese. That this, it's because it's strong, it's sharp, it's all of those things, and maybe I have a man's palate. I don't know, but you know, I like.
Does it alienate you though?
No, but I think it's clever. I think because females will be sitting at home watching telly with their other halves, and they'll say, "Oh, I like that," and they'll go and buy it for their other halves.
And still on food, the latest of Tim Bullock's work, the man behind the superhero Libra Invisible ad, was for a dip and biscuit snack, Le Snack Deli. The idea behind this one was a break from tradition, as the snack has moved from its standard cheese spread dip to something a little more gourmet. It centres around two Bavarian dancers in Lederhosen who break from tradition and dance to this.
Here we go!
It's not the first time Bullock has used a rap classic in an ad. In fact, we saw Grandmaster Flash in a Kia ad. James?
I love this ad. Tim Bullock is somebody that was great to work with, I'm told. I didn't work with him. I wasn't there at the agency at the time.
Very talented director.
Very expensive.
He's a great talent, and I think he's somebody that, you know, as an agency, we'd love to work with again, given the right opportunity.
That's the thing, because I suppose there are probably only a few directors who actually get to pick and choose scripts and stuff, because we interviewed him for the Mumbo Report a while back, and I remember him talking about that script and saying that he was in London at the time it came in, he was shooting something else, but he kind of managed to rearrange his schedule to do the Kia ad because he really liked the script.
Well, that's why I think it's worth giving a bit more credit to Ogilvy Sydney for this ad that you're looking at, because the press release, I'm sure, came from them, and it is their script that he liked and that he's brought to life. He's the storyteller that actually tells the story, but somebody's written that script first. And so they've done some good work to get that out there. And I think it's, I love the way on your report you've taken the director's angle, because it's unusual for that. But maybe that's what you do for a living.
Well, there's very few directors, actually, that you would do that for as well, I think, because, it's probably a nerdy thing, but when you see that Tim Bullock is the director of something, it's exciting to see what it's going to be like, because, you know, generally it's really good. He did the Nothing Soft Gets In stuff for Toyota as well, which again was very funny. Felt like it had, it did have really high production values, but I think he got a lot of value out of it as well.
And so, Tim, yeah. Do you think it's been since the Libra superhero thing that's really kind of given him that status?
Well, he's definitely had a hot couple of years.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think, he's had a pretty much upward trajectory since. So I think he was a suit at Saatchi's and Saatchi and Saatchi. And I think the thing that actually got him his break, if I remember rightly, was a couple of things he did for one of the film festivals.
Okay.
Probably one of the short film festivals.
Oh, yeah. With the SMH, wasn't it? The ad with the SMH?
No, way before that, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, no, when he got, just a breakthrough as a filmmaker.
Right.
I wasn't quite convinced about the break from tradition angle. Basically, I thought I had to watch it a few times. Without context, I was a little lost. Do you think that's strong enough? The fact that, it started off with Germans doing traditional dancing and then ended up with rap music. It took me a while to make that connection. Do you find it convincing?
I just thought it was funny.
But the question is, do you think the strategy was written afterwards? So the funny ad written first and then the strategy in the line to fit the to fit the funny ad.
Tim, are you suggesting that agencies might retrofit strategy to a great creative idea? I don't understand what you're insinuating.
Next, GPY and Are They in the Wrong?
Ad agency GPY&R had some unfriendly mainstream media attention over the weekend as News Limited Papers scrutinised the online behaviour of some members of its social media team and then linked that to the company's review of the Defence Force Skype scandal. At the centre of the coverage was head of social media Tip Gloria and also a member of the Digital Strategy and Insights team, Zach Martin, sort of more junior member. Also coming in for some attention was Russell Howcroft and his membership of the Facebook group in praise of Pippa Middleton's bottom. The Adelaide Advertiser said the agency's website had linked through to the staff's social media accounts, and then they alleged that one of the accounts contained what they described as pornographic images and women in compromising situations. Now, this was a Tumblr account, which generally is often just reposting of things which have been elsewhere. So why was this a story? Well, GPY&R are on the agency roster for the Australian Defence Force, which was at the centre of a scandal involving a recruit secretly broadcasting himself having sex with a colleague on Skype, and GPY&R are helping them do a social media kind of policy review. James, if your agency, or maybe that's a bit too close to the situation, how would you handle such a situation if your staff become part of the story?
I think with social media, it's a new landscape that's changing every week, and there are new rules to the game every few days. I think it's just a question of working out, have they done something wrong? Have they done something that wouldn't be, you know, that other agencies or other businesses would have done better and, or differently? I think everybody's Facebook account and everybody's social media accounts have something that you know, they might not want their grandma to see. And I think if it is your grandma that is looking at it, or the Defence Force that might be looking at it, then it's a question of working out how much are you in the wrong. These guys have been looking at reviewing a strategic policy for the Defence Force. I think that doesn't compromise the fact that a journalist has found them, has dug up some dirt from their various accounts.
And the question is, I suppose, is it even really real dirt, Robin?
Well, yeah, I mean, two things struck me about this story. One is that, you know, it's an ad agency learning the hard way about PR, courtesy of social media. But also, the thing that struck me is, will it do JPY&R any harm as a recruiter? I just wondered, James, if perhaps staff at InOcean got caught in this sort of scandal, would it actually harm your recruitment policy you're looking to hire if this sort of thing happened?
From JPY&R's perspective, I don't think it'll harm their position at all. I think they've got a good reputation. Russell Howcroft has got a high profile thanks to his TV performances. The agency has done some great work and will carry on doing some great work. I don't think it's going to affect their hiring policy at all.
Yeah, I suppose the other thing is actually, the comment was so strongly in defence of staff and JPY&R, they didn't throw anyone under the bus. I actually think if as a potential member of staff, I would look at that and think, yeah, they back the staff. Good for them.
Just on the hiring policy thing there, both as being in positions of in your company that you would be hiring staff, James and Tim, how much do you take into account Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, those kind of things, profiles on Google? Do you Google someone before you're considering hiring them?
I Google people before I even meet them, whatever the situation. I think LinkedIn is a great place to check out who you're meeting up with, just to see what have they done in life, and is there a point in common? Do you really want to meet these people? That sort of thing. I can't be bothered with Facebook. I don't care if they've got a photograph of them drunk, or whatever it might be. If they've got a blog that's linked to their LinkedIn account, or if I know about their blog, I'll have a look at that to see how they think. I don't care about people's social life, and if they've got one, great.
Next, Facebook, number one for social Aussies.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
While we're on the topic of social media, a study for Census and the Australia Interactive Media Industry Association has found some pretty surprising statistics, which have shown that Australians' use of Facebook outranks the use of Twitter and LinkedIn by quite a long way. 97% of the social media users said they used Facebook, 9% said they used LinkedIn, and 8% used Twitter. The telephone survey was of 803 people in the first 3 months of 2011. Interestingly, 64% of Twitter users said they did not follow brands at all. So, James, you're on Twitter at HereToListen. Are you on Facebook too? And do you use one more than the other?
I love Twitter because I really am there to listen and to see what other people are saying. So all the people that I follow, I enjoy hearing what they've got to say, and it's a good news feed for me. I don't have an RSS feed, and that is my RSS feed, really. And it's great for when you're out and about. You can just look at it on your mobile phone. Facebook I use occasionally and normally just to put up a photograph of my little boy doing something ridiculous so that his family back in the UK can see what he's up to, or the extended family, rather. I think that Twitter's an exciting place to be, but I not nearly as much as, I'm not nearly as prolific as obviously somebody whose life lives online, such as you guys at Mumbrella.
Right, yeah, I was going to say, Tim, we use Twitter and Facebook a lot, but what about personally? Do you lean to one more? And how about the blurring of the lines between personal and professional accounts?
Yeah, I think that the one thing I struggle with, because I spend a lot of time with Twitter, obviously, is I'm not sure how I would use it if I wasn't a journalist. I don't think I'd say very much on it. I might use it as a great means of getting interesting links and that sort of thing, because you you find people to follow are interested in things that you're interested in. But I suspect I'd have quite a small amount to say. Whereas, yeah, I mean, again, you know, Facebook, what we do on the Mumbrella group is very different to what, you know, obviously what I would do as a consumer. Personally, though, I mean, you know, the numbers are the bit that can't be argued with, and that certainly suggests that Facebook is the, you know, is the biggest opportunity. You mentioned the phone survey, and it was about 800 people, which I think, you know, perhaps demands a little bit of caution about, you know, the validity of the stats, particularly as you drill down. Although it was interesting seeing that John Grono, who's one of the kind of researchers in the media space, did comment on the posting this week, saying that actually he was reasonably comfortable with the methodology, reasonably comfortable with the sizes, having just read the document. He wasn't involved in it himself. So yeah, there are some interesting numbers. I'll try and pull out a few, actually. So we've talked about this domination of Facebook over, and I was actually slightly surprised to see that LinkedIn came slightly higher than Twitter, for instance, was one. But what was also quite interesting was the amount of times per week that people use all of these different things. So you've got Twitter, where people who do use Twitter reckon they're on it 23 times a week, which is higher than Facebook, which is about 16 on average. LinkedIn, 7 times a week. MySpace, for those who use it, 2.6 times a week. So, you know, another sort of sign of the decline of MySpace. Yeah, some stats around how many people follow, have followers or friends or contacts, depending which the one is. On average, people estimate 217.
Mm, okay. So what do you think these figures, or perhaps your observations in general about Facebook and Twitter, say about the media themselves, perhaps how brands engage with them? I've heard a generic statement made that Facebook's about engagement, Twitter is about broadcast. Sort of one way dialogue than Facebook. Perhaps, James, any thoughts on that from a brand perspective?
I think brands have to have a reason for their existence on Facebook, well, anywhere, but certainly on Facebook or Twitter. And it's a question of, how does it fit in? Is it a campaign? Does it have an end date? Or are they there for life? And therefore, what are they going to do to reward people for being a part of that group? It's all about having a long-term or a short-term engagement. And I think a lot of people just go, what are we going to do on Facebook? Rather than, why would we be there? And that's the important thing.
And funnily enough, one of the other stats, and this is where we begin to get a bit wobbly on the numbers, because it's pulling out only the Twitter users, which was only about 40 within the sample. But of those, 64% said they don't follow any brands at all on Twitter. That either says, right, well, that suggests Twitter may not be that relevant for brands, or it might say there's a big opportunity that's not being made use of, and I'm not sure which of the two it is.
So next, morning's Talent and Amateur Cooks, the past week in TV.
The ongoing battle of the breakfast shows got a little bit more interesting this week, with the Today Show on 9 topping the TV ratings on Tuesday morning. Now, the show featured a $40,000 cash giveaway in its I Wake Up With Today promotion, but executive producer Tom Malone said that the ratings win was a sign of things to come. Conversely, Seven pointed out that it's the eighth year that Sunrise has been dominating. Now, before we get into the rest of the ratings, Robin, you were the one who chatted briefly to Tom Malone. Presumably he was feeling in quite a good mood, having just picked up a relatively rare win.
He was, yes. And I think it's only the second time in, well, I think it's about a year that Today has beaten Sunrise.
Yeah, certainly in a normal day. Maybe did they do so the day after the Logies with Carl Stefanovic's gold Logie, perhaps that rings a bell, and a couple of times they've run close. Certainly it seems that the gap has been closing as well.
Yeah, and I think he did acknowledge that it was a cash giveaway that helped bump up the ratings, but he's looked back through the ratings over the past couple of years and noted that especially in Sydney and Melbourne, which he noted are Australia's two largest advertising markets, that they Today does dominate Sunrise. And the trend, he said, that breakfast TV is always about momentum, and they have the momentum. So, and he thinks that they've got a winning formula.
And James, are you a Today person or a Sunrise person?
I can't say I'm either. Actually, I don't switch the telly on when I get up, and so I'm not going to participate in this conversation.
Speaking of ratings domination, MasterChef seems to be coming back up against Australia's Got Talent. The Amazing Race, Australia and Come Fly With Me, been dropping away slightly. And the big audience of the week was State of Origin, which rated 2.227 million, down slightly on last year, but still a sizeable audience. Robin, MasterChef back on the up, do you think? Obviously State of Origin down a bit, but you know, not massively surprising, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I've caught a couple of episodes of MasterChef, but I can't say I've followed the thread of the story. I think that MasterChef's a show with a story that builds, so I can't really comment confidently about that. But the gap that I noted this week, that there's a gap that's a gulf that's grown between MasterChef and Australia's Got Talent, which I don't know, do you think that will worry the producers at 10, that perhaps their show has lost its sparkle?
Well, I wonder whether some of it is like it does happen in cycles for all of these shows telling the story. So what we've had is Australia's Got Talent, and there's very, very early auditions and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they talk about the J curve, don't they? You know, you get the spike, then it dips, then it builds. And obviously Australia's Got Talent is a few weeks behind MasterChef in its cycle, so I suspect we're just beginning to see MasterChef build now. In theory, we'll see Australia's Got Talent build behind it, so it wouldn't surprise me if it challenges it again.
And Come Fly With Me, perhaps that's the show that you watch to begin with. If you think it's funny, you'll keep watching. But if you don't, you won't watch again. James, have you seen Come Fly With Me, which is from the makers of Little Britain?
I haven't, but I've got it all recorded on IQ. And that's one of the things. I'm a very bad appointment to view viewer. I do everything through Foxtel IQ or through ABCI. And so therefore, I just watch it when I've got time. And I probably do watch an hour or two of TV most days, but it'll be catching up on previous stuff. So I can't comment on it, but I enjoy Little Britain, and I'm pretty sure I'll enjoy this one, although I heard last, you know, from your last podcast that none of you guys really liked it that much. So I hope I haven't got the same taste as you.
Not really. Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't help but to compare it to Angry Boys, Chris Lilley's show, just in terms of, you know, a big ticket Australian comedy versus a big ticket a British one. I did think that Angry Boys was much funnier.
And Angry Boys really did suffer against State of Origin, you know, well below the million mark. So it's going to be very interesting when we're back to normal with the ratings next week to see how it goes. Next, to pitch or not to pitch?
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. So we have a speaker at next month's Mumbrella 360 conference who's written a book on winning clients without pitching. His name is Blair Enns, and he is a Canadian new business expert who claims that agencies waste their time and energy and give their best ideas away for free when they're pitching. Enns argues that there's better ways to win business without giving away your best ideas. Meanwhile, in a separate session, pitch doctors Peter McDonald and Darren Woolley will explain what to do if you do pitch. So, James, what are your thoughts on pitching?
Pitching's great. It's the adrenaline, it's the excitement, it's the staying up through the night to try and get it done. But it's so much cheaper and more efficient if you don't have to pitch. And therefore, the best way for any agency to win business is to get to know the prospective clients in advance of the pitch and then work on projects and to grow those projects and to say, here's how we can do well and we can grow that within internally, which is why I think Blair Enns is, you know, coming to tell people how to win without pitching makes absolute sense.
As an outsider, I do enjoy the drama and the theatre of pitching. And a question I may well put to Peter McDonald and Darren Woolley at 360 is, what about stunts? When is a good time to do a stunt, or are they best avoided at all costs?
We've all heard about the stunts, but I think a stunt, no matter how cunning it is not worth putting together unless there's a payoff. And it's just a case of, is it just a woo, and is it just a wow, or is it to really
right.
woo?
Yeah.
And I think if you're going to demonstrate extra knowledge by revamping your agency as a supermarket for, you know, something that I did years ago to win the Heinz business back in the UK, we just turned the boardroom into a massive great supermarket from either side, just with all the walls and all the products and their competing products.
And presumably it's the sort of thing that if you're going to do that, you have to do it very well. You can't do it half-heartedly.
Well, you can either do that, you can do it very well, or you can just have their product stuck on a table at the end of the room, which is, you know, okay, but doesn't have the same impact. But it's really just about saying we understand the environment and not just the above the line environment, but also where people buy your product.
I'll tell you one thing that has sort of struck me a bit is I've not ever been on a live pitch, but I've been in various agency awards where there's a live presentation to the jury. And every single time after there's a massive piece of theatre, pitch theatre as it often is, the minute the door shuts after they leave, the first thing the judges say to themselves as they leave is, yeah, lots of style. Was there any substance? And I must have heard that line and that question a dozen times. So I guess that's the risk of the pitch theatre.
It's everything in life has to have a purpose. And if you don't know what you're trying to achieve and just trying to look glitzy and glamorous, it's pointless. There are different ways to look at it, and I'm sure, you know, Peter, who's the Peter McDonald that you mentioned, who's the eternal cynic about everything, he's got one perspective, and Dan, who's the eternal sort of optimist about everything, and scathing optimist, I think.
Now, Robin, you're moderating the session with Peter and Darren. How are you going to structure it?
Well, I think the best way to play this would be for Peter, he's going to stand up and do 10 minutes about the perfect pitch. And Darren is going to counter that with the worst case scenario pitch, the worst possible pitch. And then we can have discussion for the next 30 minutes or so. That's a question perhaps for you, James. What's the worst pitch you've ever been involved in? And how did it go so badly wrong?
Well, just first of all, I think the idea of that session with Peter telling about the perfect pitch and then Darren telling about the worst pitch sounds like an awful session of all the nightmares of, oh, I wish I'd done that, and oh, God, I'm glad I never did that. I think a pitch goes badly when you walk away from it going, oh, I wish we hadn't done that, or I wish we'd done it the way that somebody else suggested, or the way I said, whatever it might be. That's when you know you've done it wrong. Otherwise, you're going to walk away from any pitch going, it went well, I think, but I'm not quite sure. And if you walk away from a pitch thinking it went brilliantly, you've probably completely missed
the sort of feeling you get when you've done an exam, and if you're overconfident, you've usually had a nightmare. That sort of feeling.
It is a bit like that. If you are too confident, it means you didn't look at all the it's a knife edge. You know? So there's an agency in the UK called JFDI, and I won't say what the F is, but it's Just Do It. And the reason that agency always is brought into ad agencies is that they are very good at being a good sounding board. But one of the things they say is just don't give up on the pitch, because you never know whether or not you're going to have won. So keep going. And just like the Blues last night, you've got to keep going. And sometimes you win and sometimes you don't.
Well, you can hear about how not to pitch or how to pitch at Mumbrella 360, which is June the 7th and 8th. If you want more details, mumbrella360.com.au.
Next, does the public care about journalism?
Fairfax staff staged a flash mob at Sydney's Martin Place on Thursday, which I think has been officially designated somewhere as the home of the flash mob. Robin, you were there. What did the public make of it?
Well, it was interesting. A few days prior to me turning up to this, I'd ridden through Martin Place as a massive mob of people protesting about the ill treatment of Christians in Egypt, throngs of people. But here it was very different. I did get the sense that the public, they're on their way to work. They didn't want to be stopped by people with clipboards, let alone journalists. And my sense was, having spoken to a couple of the members of the public, that they weren't that sympathetic to some sub-editors losing their jobs.
I suppose the hard thing is when you're saying, look, the thing is, I'm on $120,000. I know it's twice what you earn, but they're going to outsource it to somebody who earns the same as you. It's a hard conversation to have, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I didn't get the sense there was public sympathy for them. But at the end of the day, they're people that are losing their jobs. And
journalists are people too.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And there's some very high-profile journalists there from the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sun Herald. I didn't get the sense either that people knew who these people were. I had a chat with Jonathan Est
from the Media Alliance, friend of the podcast.
Yes, that's right. And he was saying that, in fact, a survey that they did of the public, they did a cloud.
Ah, yes,
A think cloud.
They did where a tag cloud where all the words are different sizes, yes.
Yes, and the biggest word was I don't know in response to the question of which journalist can you name from Fairfax or News Limited?
Yes, and I seem to remember when they took out that answer, I think Tim Blair came top, didn't he?
No, it's Andrew Bolt.
Right,
he was the one person, the one journalist that they actually knew, and the rest they didn't really. So I didn't get the sense there's much sympathy at all.
Do you think they knew Andrew Bolt because of his profile on television? Do you think it was because of, you know, whether
being
it was
on
because
the
insider
sort of
and he's a guest on the Today Show when they do their what's happening in the media thing? I wonder if really if he hadn't had his profile on television, whether they would have known him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I did get the sense that his politics and his profile certainly put him in that sort of...
Because I think, yeah, print bylines mean very little indeed, is my sense.
Yeah. James, I mean, for instance, got you on the spot here, but could you name... Who's your favourite journalist? Who's your favourite Fairfax journalist? Could you name one? Could you name two?
I can only name the marketing journalists, and so I won't go into that. But what I do think is important is that until you have your face on TV, people don't know who you are as consumers. That's why I think putting on a stunt in Martin Place without... and expecting people to really understand the plight of the journalist and the sub-editor is asking too much of the general public, because frankly it's a don't care category. It's a just give me my news and I don't want to pay for it online. That sort of argument is much more understood by consumers. And I think until you're on TV, you're not known, and that's why you'll put in. Once you're on TV, Andrew Bolt, a good example. Whether they love you or hate you, they'll know you and have an opinion about you. So till then, it's not the right way to go about raising awareness for your plight.
And that is all we have time for today. Special thanks to Notion's James Welsh.
Thank you, Tim.
To Mumbrella's Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
And podcast producer Alice Telikovsky.
Thanks very much.
The Mumbrella cast was recorded at the studios of CBS Interactive. And if you haven't booked your ticket for Mumbrella 360, make sure to visit mumbrella360.com.au. See you next week. Toodle pip.
So, still on food, the latest work of Tim Bollock...
That's a blue
phone. That was
going after the end credits.
Definitely. Thanks, Robin.
Optimist, I think. Now, Tim, you're Tim. No, I'm Tim, aren't I? Man, I'm sorry, Alice. This is going to be so hard to edit.
Tim Bollock.
Right. Everyone be quiet. I'm going to get my question in.